This interview was brought to you by the Omega Center. The Omega Center is an online forum striving to facilitate a deepening of consciousness, conversation, and connection as we seek God in our scientific age. The website is dedicated to education, formation, and inspiration in the converging fields of science and theology. We've been exploring the theme of love in a fractured world. Our emphasis this month in October has been to explore a theology of love. And what does it mean to say God is love in a world of violence and suffering? There's so much friction in our world right now. Our politicians are yelling at each other. We're yelling at each other on Facebook. And what you can sense underneath it is the fear, the panic. Where are things headed? There's so much violence in our words, in our actions, in our world. How do we locate God in the midst of so much change and in the midst of uncertainty? Ilia Delio, Franciscan Sister of Washington, D.C., an American theologian, joins us on Skype to discuss this question. Of course, it wouldn't be a conversation about suffering if it weren't complete with technology issues. Our Skype connection was particularly frail, and there's definitely some weird buzzing going on. But bear with us, and hopefully you can still enjoy this dialogue. Once we both had wine in hand, after several failed attempts at trying to record our conversation, I began this dialogue by just talking about Ilia's first blog post on the Omega Center this month. She describes the modern malady of thinned time and asked if there's maybe a correlation between our inability to think about God and the flattening of our interior lives. She said that life has become like MapQuest. Our attention is focused on how to get from here to there. And I asked her, do you think that this has anything to do with why so many of us younger people are starved for depth and are looking for it in mindfulness and yoga and meditation? Because there is this intuition that maybe we do need to slow down and reevaluate what is meaningful. Maybe there's this growing intuition that God or the infinite can't be touched through these technological systems of expediency. Here's Ilia.
Yeah, wow, that's a good question, Bree. I mean, actually, I was reading this evening as I was preparing for class for Wednesday, and class is going to center on consciousness and evolution. And I was looking at a physicist by the name of Michio Kaku, I think it is, a Japanese physicist, who defines consciousness in relationship to our geographical space-time location. And so it's really interesting. In our very thinned out, fragmented world, we're not locating any particular terrain. We're locating multiple terrains simultaneously. And I think our consciousness cannot really find its own locale, so to speak, for one thing. I mean, I think our consciousness is so, again, spread out with our own lives that it's really quite mysterious, because consciousness is sort of that sixth sense. I mean, it's the sixth sense that, in a sense, is the unified sense that coordinates all other senses. So when our consciousness is fragmented or thinned out, all the rest of our lives are thinned out as well. And I think that's the lack of interiority. You know, when we talk about lack of interiority, in other words, there's no consciousness in a geographical space-time that allows me to recognize myself and myself as part of, or coming from God. So those things are interconnected, as Raymond Panikkar wisely pointed out so many years ago. So I do think, I think we have a crisis of consciousness. Maybe that's how I put it briefly. So I think we've invented these devices to make our lives more efficient and faster, and we have now lives that are more fragmented, polarized, and like pancakes. You know, we're like fried eggs on a Sunday morning. And so we don't have any sense of self-identity. Who are we as human persons? you know, what is our purpose or meaning here? Do we have any higher purpose or any greater purpose than simply, you know, getting up in the morning and surviving, you know, in the MapQuest world from going from here to there? And, you know, and what do we live for? I mean, you know, is it just really to get through the day? Really? And it's rather sad that we have kind of reduced our lives to this really concentration camp mode, you know, like we're just barely eking out an existence. Because the name of the game is consciousness. And I think that's what spirituality is about, you know, and I think it's harnessing those energies within us for a deepening of a feedback loop, so to speak, between myself, my existence in this world, and my existence in this world, in an ultimate ground of this world that we name as God.
So like the connection has been lost between ourselves and the whole.
Yes, sort of like my Skype connection this evening.
Yes,
it's become like our computers, you know, we have these kind of like system breakdowns, and we're in like a large computer meltdown right now.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, it's a systems failure. That's what we're suffering from.
Yeah.
You know, and I think the primary engine of the whole thing failing is our consciousness, and with that, our soul.
Do you think, I mean, one of the things that I'm noticing a lot is the way that we use words feels like it's also flattened, like that loss of interiority has is spread itself into our use of language and how we communicate with each other. I mean, you know, we send out texts and it's all fast. It's fast email. Communication is quick. It's reactive. And I feel that we've lost the connection between our words and the meaning even, you know, I mean, we're seeing it in our political landscape right now. Oh, well, I didn't mean that. Or, oh, that was just locker room talk. But yet words carry an action. So is this part of the disconnect that you're seeing as well?
It is. I think, you know, again, I think we use words too cheaply. And I think our words, they're like our information bits. They have, you know, in the past, words had depth, they had content, and they were meant to, they were transforming. You know, a word could change a life. And today we have lost, again, even the conscious dimension of word itself. And so we use words like they're consumer products, you know. We buy them, we throw them out, you know, we throw them at people, we discard them. And so we have lost the ability of the word and language to transform us. And I do think that goes hand in hand with that lack of interiority. There's no depth to our lives. There's no depth to the words we're using. And so there's no depth of in other words, there's no thoughtfulness to the use of words. We kind of just use these words sporadically and reactively rather than thoughtfully and carefully. And so I think our crisis of interiority, our crisis of consciousness has led to cheap words. And cheap words makes for cheap society. You know, it means that people do not count as people. They're just objects, you know, that can be easily discarded or, you know, like dartboards. You can throw darts at them. You know, that the human person is no longer person. We're just commodities, you know. We're just sort of collateral damage in power games at times. And so I think we need a moratorium on words. You know, we need maybe a grand silence, you know, and to reflect on what are we saying and who are we, you know, who are we saying it to? I don't even think we recognize who we're talking to at times. We're just sort of spewing these words out of a fractured inner self or lack of inner self. And, you know, words can hurt as well as words can heal. And I think we use words like weapons.
Yeah.
And so we sort of have sort of, you know, levels of war going on in the way we use words. And I think that these are acts of violence. I think our use of words that hurt and destroy others, these are acts of violence that need to be resisted.
So if love is then that which connects what is fractured in our world, And we ourselves have the capacity to be agents of that unifying force. It seems that our use of language could be part of that, like you're saying. And I mean, I remember a poetry teacher once told me, you know, you don't read poetry in your mind. You have to speak it out loud. And I wonder about that. Like we've become so disconnected even from the resonance of how words feel and sound in our chests and our bodies and in our throats and in our mouths. And I wonder about that, if that could be part of our practice as we try to be more holistic and mindful about how we engage with words, especially in such a fast age information culture where we're just, you know, typing away and sending stuff out. And so I wonder what you would recommend for us to begin to slow down that process and remember that what we speak actually has an effect in this world.
Yeah. Well, I think, you know, I think what you're asking here, or what you're saying here, is very good, because I think there are interconnected ideas here. First of all, I think an age of internet connections and texting and tweeting, where, you know, the most significant parts of our physiology are our thumbs or our, you know, our forefingers. Exactly. So when we use words in these kind of terrains, you know, where they're electronic bits of information that convey partial ideas, we lose sense of the word as embodied, right? Mm-hmm. So we have sense of just an idea that I can either accept or reject at the touch of a button, right? Mm-hmm. So again, I think we're even beyond now, you might say, the threshold of class of the traditional use of language, you know, this kind of instant communication type thing. But it goes hand in hand with the profound disembodiment, I think, that our technological age has afforded us, that, you know, we are cyborgs, we are hybridized persons now, we're like embodied techno devices, you know, we are our devices, so to speak. Or our devices are us. So we have no sense. So in other words, not so much a sense, but things are really rapidly shifting for us. And they're shifting in such a breathless way, in such a fast way, we're not even sure if we want to go there. And we're not even really profoundly reflective of the consequences they're having on us as persons and as relational beings. So I think, you know, I do think, it, you know, it really depends, what do we want? Do we want to remain as human persons? Do we want to become post-human? You know, do we want to become techno-sapiens? Because that is where we're going. And in that new level of existence, words will have a whole different meaning than what they had in our human existence as Homo sapiens. Personally, what I loved about words in the Homo sapien existence, if I think of the ancients, you know what I mean?
It's already passed.
We're living on different levels of evolution. I think we got to name that, you know, and not,
true.
You can't just talk to this, all this is Homo, like nothing has really changed and we just got some updated devices.
Right.
They have really transformed us.
Oh, yeah.
And we are, you know, impartial. In other words, the rate of evolution, the evolution of our species, is happening at different rates around the globe, you know, just depending on, you know, our use and interuse of technology. But I do think, here's the thing, what I liked about the ancients is that not only their slow time and their thoughtful use of language, we were talking about the desert tradition, right, recently, and, you know, the desert fathers and mothers, where words were used sparingly. You know, and you know, the famous anecdotes of the desert fathers, you know, where the young monk comes to the ancient father and says, you know, Abba, I want to, you know, what is it? I've read the rule and I practice, I fast every day. You know, what more should I do? And the abbot says to him, he just looks at him, you know, in silence and says, go home and pray. You know, so the young monk goes home and prays, and he comes back like the following year, and he's asked the same thing. You know, Abba, I fasted, I prayed. You know, what more must I do to become holy? And the abbot just looks at him again and says, "You're not ready." You know, and that type of, you know, in our own age, that type of thing. That's just, you know, outrageous. Like, you know, are you kidding? I'm not ready. This is my second time around and this will happen, type thing. So in the Desert Fathers were about this. Words have depth. Like the word of God has transformational power. But any word, you know, has transformational power. And it's not just the word. It is that the word is then our life. You know, the word transforms us so that we become word. We're language. Mm-hmm. And I think that's what's being lost today, is not just the words that we're using. That just is symbolic of how disconnected we are. Mm-hmm. But we're the language. You know, we humans, that is the Christian basis. The word becomes flesh. So that, you know, the famous line, like, you may be the only gospel someone reads this day. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like people read us. They don't just see us. And our bodies are expressing something. Just as words express things, our bodies express things. If we're so disconnected from our bodies and our minds and our souls, then we use these cheap, you know, data bits, you know, these informational bits that have no transforming value to them. And so it's a crisis of language we're in, you know, amidst many things. And I think a crisis of language is a crisis of relationship, because it's a crisis of communication.
Yeah.
And that's fertile field for war.
Yeah. And it's because we've lost the connection of what's happening within. So therefore, we've lost the connection of what's happening around us and our connection to one another as well. You know, I mean, I've been thinking about that word expression a lot, and I like looked it up, you know, what are the origins of this word in the Latin expressere, but it's ex, you know, out, and then presser, which is like pushing out. So it's push out. So it's this idea that there is something within us that gets pressed out. And of course, whenever I hear that language, I immediately think of like an olive press, you know, that like that pushing, you know, the wrenching that creates this fine oil, which is like the most valuable properties of the olive itself, you know. So we've lost this, you know, and we've become so vapid and, you know, just unfiltered with our language. And I think that goes back to our thoughts, how we handle our thoughts, how, you know, we're always just kind of going and thinking and thinking and thinking and assuming that everything that is in our minds must come out our mouths. And so, you know, we've lost also the connection to stopping and to time, like you said. I mean, I think we talked about this the other day, that there was a desert father who put a stone in his mouth. I think it was Abba Agathon or something. He put a stone in his mouth. It was said of Abba Agathon that he lived with a stone in his mouth for 3 years until he learned the value of silence. I'm like,
yeah.
But there's that time thing that you're mentioning again, that we have become a culture of consumerism and expediency to the point where now we don't know how to slow down enough to remember what's actually worth expressing at all.
Right. Right, I really think we have become enslaved to the power of consumerism and marketing and advertisements. And, you know, they play on our desires and our needs, and they don't give us, the culture no longer gives us sufficient space to really pull back and ask, what do I want? You know, what do I desire? And so I think that it's almost like having an elephant constantly sitting on us, you know. I mean, the pressures of the world. Hmm. In other words, the pressures of consumerism, the pressures of the need to have this and that, you know, to be faster and smarter and live longer and live healthier and, you know, overcome this disease and overcome this ailment. And it's endless. And rather than accepting the limits of our being, you know, they are contingent, right? And maybe learn through the frailties of our lives new ways to transcend our limits in love. You know, sometimes suffering can be a blessing in disguise, in that it causes us to slow down and we have to reprioritize our lives, you know, what's really important to us. And I think we are, as a world, I find ourselves on this breathless, we're on a global treadmill. And I see this happening like throughout the entire world, no matter what country you're looking at. And I think the cost is our own humanity. And so we have become, I think, a world out of control. You know, we are, in a sense, a species out of control. And either we're going to have to wake up and do some radical taking back, you know, our humanity by some radical ascetical practices, like really discipline, like to make hard choices for ourselves, or we will, in a sense, suffer the consequences of what out of control looks like. So it's not to be all gloom and doom, but you can kind of see there are patterns going on. Mm-hmm. You know, the pattern flattening out this interior life, which has been happening now, I would say, since the High Middle Ages, or since the rise of modern science. Not that science is responsible for it at all, but it's just that we see this kind of separation between science and religion. We see the lures of materialism and consumerism. We find ourselves with the need to transcend ourselves, you know, which is what technology does for us. But at the same time, spirituality also does that for us, you know. And so we've lost sight of the power of spirituality to transform us and to lead us into new levels of existence. We don't even think of spirituality as a type of technology of the spirit, you know, which it is.
Yeah.
And so we have become enamored by our own creations. We fail to see the power of God's love at the heart of our lives that continues to invite us to lay down our weapons of self and mass destruction, and that are on many different levels, and really to go inward. As Jesus said, go into your room and just stay there, be silent and pray.
You just said a minute ago, and I think you said this in your blog too, when you were talking about Heidegger's view of God as an activity that's imminent in this world. You say that he said it takes an emergency to wake us up. And so love itself, you know, we tend to equate love with just like the nice and cozy and the comfortable, but the way you're describing it, it sounds like love often takes us into these burnouts, into the chaos, into the emergency, so that we can wake up and snap out of it and reconnect once more. So I wonder if that could be a new way to view some of what's happening in our current events in our world right now, even, you know, in our personal lives and in the macro bigger stuff that's happening.
Yeah, I think, you know, we have our culture again. I think, you know, our pop culture especially has really done a disservice to love. In a sense, we have pulverized it and we have reduced it to emotion and sentiment and body and, you know, something that's so superficial, you can easily just fall in and out of it like water.
Like consumerism. It's like another form of consumerism.
Exactly. Yeah. It is exactly what it's become, another form of consumerism, where we are saying that there is at the heart of us, there's a deep, profound love. I mean, that love of God is of the infinite, that ultimate goodness that we are created for. And I think, you know, I love that saying from St. Augustine where he says, you know, our hearts are restless until they rest in you. There's a deep restlessness because we have the capacity for ultimate union with ultimate love, you know, which is God. And so we will never, never be satisfied with anything, I think, created. I mean, in the sense that we'll always want to transcend ourselves. And I think we are created for a higher love. I mean, that's not just a noble idea. That's what we're created for. That's the whole thing. Every person is, you know, according to their own capacity, according to their own personality. But I think that higher love means we got to get beyond the dross and we got to get beyond the partials, you know, everything that obscures that love, because that love, it's like digging for gold. You know, you dig for gold. Literally, you have to go in and you must sift through hours, days, months, years, you know, all the sediment where the gold is lying from within. And there's something similar to that, you know, in our own lives that we have to sift through. That's discernment. We have to, in a sense, suffer through. That means, you know, you gotta get down and under. You gotta enter into the fray. You have to enter into the chaos sometimes, because it's hidden. I think the very love that is that transforming love, which we constantly aspire to, is not superficial. That's precisely what it's not.
Right.
It's not the big blowout sale, you know. It's the treasure hidden within, you know. And I think we've lost the capacity to work for the treasure, and that means to lean into when the difficulties of life, you know, to accept that life has its fragilities, it has its contingencies, right? And some of it we can move beyond and avoid, and some of it we have to just work our way through and find what is going on, what's the meaning here? What am I being called to through this chaos? Mm. You know, what am I being called to in this suffering? Not to shirk suffering, but to accept it as part of the growing process of life itself, right? I think Teilhard de Chardin would see suffering as the flip side of creative union. Mm. He would say, you know, suffering's not the end, it's not the fatality and finality. It is a call or an inspiration to a creativity that's potent within, that's waiting to take place. And I think we need to, that's the type of journey into that higher love. Mm-hmm. Through the sufferings, we ask, well, what are we being called to in this suffering? What's the creative moment here? Mm-hmm. You know, it means shifting our attention and shifting our, you know, and locating within our interior lives, you know, that deeper desire.
Yeah. I mean, that's the hard part, right? Because it's like, it almost seems like what you're describing requires such a rootedness to be able to go deep and within and to hold still in the midst of suffering, to not react, because we're so, you know, we're so primed to be in our like flight or fight kind of mentality. We don't know how to hold ourselves in suffering. It's so uncomfortable. It makes me think of like, I had a ballet teacher, her name was Olga. I mean, like, what a name, right? Olga. And she was Russian. And she used to have us sit up against the wall, and then she would face us, and she would take her heels and push out our legs until they were completely 180 degrees, like flat up again. And she'd pin us there. Yeah.
Oh, my goodness.
We'd hang onto the bars, and we would just, like, make the most absurd sound. It was so painful. It was so uncomfortable. And she would just look at us and be like, you will do nothing in ballet if you do not do this. You know, I mean, like, just forceful, like. But she was, of course, she was right. Because without that flexibility, you know, there's no grace in movement. And yet, so like I have this visceral memory of that feeling. And whenever I find myself in my life in the midst of great tension or suffering, that's what it feels like. I feel like I'm being split, and I'm like, I don't know if I can bear this. So how do we ground? How do we embody and not just try to explain it away or react? What are some ways that we can be in the midst of that and accept that as part of our evolution?
Well, you know, I think first of all, I think we have tremendous power to withstand. You know, I think like what you're describing with your ballet teacher, but I think of the gymnasts and the Olympics, you know, I mean, the training that they go through. The human person, first of all, has tremendous power. We have tremendous resiliency, and we have a tremendous power to withstand, you know, endurance. That's really the word I'm looking for here. But I think in the face of, you know, in face of trials and tribulations and sufferings, I do think that type of withstanding, it does require an effort of the will. In other words, it requires the ability to focus our minds on what we really want in that moment. I think it requires a type of, you cannot have a lot of interior stuff in that moment, like conflicting stuff. You have to empty yourself at that moment, just for that moment, to focus, you know, in a sense, on achieving, if you're going to do ballet or gymnastics. But I think that's the same thing in spiritual life. You know, again, going back to the Desert Fathers, it's an act of the will. That will is such a strange and mysterious part of our human nature. Like, we have the will. We have this ability to choose. You know, we can do things that seem impossible at times. Mm. I think Charlotte Tomano spoke about this in one of her blogs, about, you know, focusing the mind. Mm. And that's a lot of what spirituality and prayer is about. It's about training the mind or focusing the mind. We can actually focus the mind on, you know, on higher things that will, in that focus of mind, where our minds are, there the rest of us lie, so that when suffering does come, you know, we endure it with a different level of consciousness. We endure it with a different level of endurance. And I think, going back to where we began this conversation, the lack of the flattening out of the mind, the flattening out of the interior life, is also the inability to endure even the least trial or even the least, you know, suffering. You know, we constantly want retribution. We want to get even. We want, you know, retaliation. We want to avoid suffering. We're going to take a pill for it or, you know, put it away. And so these are interlocking constituencies of human personhood that we're losing. And as we're losing them because we're losing the depth of our personhood as person. And I think that may be a great trial for us up ahead is, you know, do we want to remain as human persons or not? As robotics enter our culture, as we will be soon moving, you know, within the next 10 to 15 years from computers into implanted chips, you know, as we, as Ray Kurzweil says, you know, we cross the singularity, you know, and become completely sapiens. So, you know, and all of this to say is what's really at stake is not just the mind. I think the whole depth of spiritual life, the depth of the human spirit, the depth of spirituality, the depth of God really is what we become, you know, totally immune to. So, and you can see, you know, religion is so marginalized in our culture. There's a great yearning for spirituality because there's a great yearning for interiority, a great yearning for depth. But we have some real choices to make. There's no one who will do it for us. It doesn't matter what president we elect, you know, in this view. Mm. You know, it doesn't matter what government we have in this view. Mm. It really does matter, though. What do we want? Not do we want personally? What do we want collectively? What do we want as a human community? You know, what do we want as a community in Michigan or in Pennsylvania, or you know, in the United States? Mm. We don't even have. We don't have a collective soul. You know, we don't.
Yeah, and I think you're putting your finger on something that I think is really interesting, which is that this flattening out has caused us to forget our own agency, our own power in the universe. And I think this is our frustration with religion, at least mine. It's like we project all of the, you know, the capacity for becoming onto this person of Jesus, forgetting that we ourselves are meant to be the body of Christ who can also become incarnate, you know. So I'd like, it's frustrating. I remember back to the Desert Fathers. I love that we keep talking about the Desert Fathers, but
they are great. You guys.
I can't remember who it was, and I'm going to be mad at myself tomorrow for not remembering this, but you know, there was one desert father that said, if you will, you can become all flame. And he lifted his hands to the heaven. Yeah. And there was, you know, but the thing that strikes me about what he said is the word can. You can. If you will, you can become all flame. And I remember hearing this for the first time and thinking, my God, like we've forgotten what we're capable of, and we've forgotten that we as human beings have created these systems of thought, and we can create new systems of thought, and that we are in this process of evolution together, and that we can actually create change and create a new world. And it's like we've lost our imagination.
Yeah, no, that's a really excellent point. That's a really important point, Bree, is that a personal agency may be one of the most important and valuable ideas that we have lost sight of. And I think you named it correctly that we have, in a sense, you know, in the ancient ages past, we transferred that power of agency to the institution of religion. But we've done the same thing in our own era. Even though we've marginalized or dispensed with religion, we've transferred the power from religion to consumerism, or the same power that we gave to religion to technology. Mm-hmm. So same thing, you know, we're still transferring the power of agency to other outside sources. And whether it's institutional religion or technology or consumerism, they all make us make us passive, and controllable, you know. And rather than, and the whole point of the incarnation is the empowerment of the whole point of Jesus is personal agency, you know. Unless, as you said, you know, Jesus says, unless you acquire the heart of a child. You know, the kingdom of God is among you. Mm-hmm. You know? And he kept stressing that, like, mm-hmm. you need to turn around and make new decisions here. Mm-hmm. You know, something new is happening, but you need to be there. Mm-hmm. Like, God's not going to do it for you, you know. Yeah. And so it's so amazing how many people, and not just old, I find some young people too think like this, you know, that we just transfer all our, you know, all that we want onto God, and God's going to do it for us. And or we transfer it onto technology, and technology's going to do it for us. Or we transfer it onto government, and government's going to do it for us.
Right.
No, mm-hmm. none of it is true. You know, mm-hmm. and we have made, if we go extinct, it's because we will have made ourselves extinct.
Well, exactly. You know? I mean, we find ourselves saying, like, well, how did we get here? How did we, in this political, like, you know, milieu, like, how did this happen? You know, oh, well, it's because we've been sort of blindly, passively accepting, you know, decision by decision, we've been participating by our absence of participation.
Yeah, exactly. And that's why I think it really is worthwhile to go back to the ancients, you know, the mystics in the Christian tradition, the Sufi tradition,
yeah.
you know, the Jewish tradition. I mean, the Buddhist, you know, my Buddhist nun who I read a few years ago, not Pema Chodron, but, you know, some really great, great people who recognize the power of the will and the power of the mind, you know, that can be trained. And that, you know, the Buddha saying, the mind creates the world and not the other way around. And Jesus said the same thing, where your mind is, there, you know, the rest lies. Mm. And that's what we're saying, that all of that is about personal agency. It's about taking responsibility and knowing the power within us and what we're, and this almost unlimited depth that we have to do amazing, amazing things. You know, we have the capacity to transcend ourselves. You know, we have the capacity to do new things. That's what technology is actually showing us, you know. But we, you know, we don't recognize that power as the power of God. You know, God loves new things. You know, God loves to do new things. And I think God has given us that power to do new things in a sense of co-creating a new world.
Let's pause for a second. I mean, how often do you think about God that way? God is that which calls us to transcend ourselves? I mean, could God be the evolutionary instinct for more? The creative urge to pick up a brush, write a song, write a book, to express ourselves. Could that be God? And what if all of the suffering, the friction, is somehow part of the creative process? Anyway, back to Ilya.
I mean, Jesus, I guess, could have said, hey, you know, don't bother because, you know, listen, I've got the power, so you know, I'll just do it
this.
Myself.
I got it, right.
You know, but just the opposite, right?
Yeah.
Total powerlessness.
Right.
And there's a line that I use in my classes, you know, from Cardinal Walter Kasper's book on the God of Jesus Christ, where he says something to the effect like the omnipotence of God is the powerlessness of God. Mm. And we don't get that, what the incarnation is about. It is the self-emptying of God into otherness, and we are that other.
Yeah.
And we have yet to get that.
Like, I love how we spend so much time on the story of the prodigal son, you know, and we're like, oh, the poor prodigal. And I forget who said this. I think it might have been Cynthia Bourgeau in a class at some point. She said, God is the prodigal. God is the one who's squandering, you know, everything away. And, you know, it brings us back to this idea of not running away from suffering or chaos, like, but that the universe itself seems to be creating itself in the midst of suffering and chaos. So I wonder if switching that lens allows us to trust, you know, because I think about, okay, so what does this self-emptying feel like? And it feels to me like trust. It feels like releasing my control, which is terrifying for us as human beings, my small narrative, and accepting my connection to the whole becoming of things. And
right.
So what would happen if we, as you know, persons of a community would begin to think of trusting the chaos,
yeah,
and trusting the suffering, and to accept it from that perspective with an energy of anticipation that, okay, this is chaotic, this is hard, this is painful, something's happening, something's going to be birthed. It's just that's what we can, you know, this is what nature tells
right.
us.
It does, actually. I mean, there's a new field of biology opening up called quantum biology, and a new book called Life on the Edge, where the authors state that all of the biological world and its many levels, you know, is working on this edge between quantum physics. In other words, the world of quantum entanglement and the world of potentialities and structured processes, so that, you know. What we are saying is that maybe the most fundamental laws of life are not Newtonian laws. They may be the quantum laws. In other words, pluralism, potentialities, chaos,
and
a disorder means that, that our lives are always on the edge between order and disorder. They're always on the edge between love and suffering. They're always on the edge between death and new life. And I think we have made these binary opposites. Love is the opposite of suffering. Death is the opposite of life, you know. And so by making them opposites, we make them in opposition to one another. And so we keep trying to flock to one and avoid the other. And by doing that, we become out of sync with nature. Nature works on the edge between death and life, between, you might say, suffering and flourishing. And I think that for us as humans to live on that edge between suffering and love is to live with an openness, for one thing. And I think that openness is the trust that, you know, that there is an other at the heart of this life, you know, that there is an ultimate love, you know, that ultimate whole that is God. And I think that, that trust is first the openness and then the letting go. Because as much as we try to control things, the control thing is really an illusion, you know, although we do feel good about it most of the time, right? But, you know, it's an illusion, big control. We're no less a control than anything else. I mean, and nature does not work by control. It works by cooperation, by synergy, by, in a sense, trusting the other members of the niche, so to speak. And I think we have to come to a new level of trust, not just the process, but trusting one another. We don't trust other people. You know, the other who is different from me, it could be is more likely my enemy than my sister or brother. We have no sense of belonging to a cosmic family together. And I think only so again the interweaving of the consciousness of self, the consciousness of God, and the consciousness of belonging to this godly creation together. So that, you know, in times of suffering, it's not greed over need, or let me just take all that I can and whatever I have left over, you know, maybe you can have. It is rather that we're in this together, right? So that we share, you know, we share these resources together. We will suffer this together, and we will rise together, you know, into a new life. But we need a new level of definitely of a consciousness of, and I would say, you know, that idea of leaning into the flow, trusting, in a sense that God does love adventure, and God is okay with chaos, and God is okay with suffering as well, you know, because love is so much greater, right? The power of love is always working through that suffering, and there's something new that's emerging. I guess that's what, you know, that's what evolution, in a sense, is telling us over and over and over again.
You can trust this process.
You can trust. And the more we try to control and hold on the more we will die. That is just also the life of nature.
It seems, even full circle to come back to the importance of embodiment, right? Because I think where we spin out and feel most isolated is from our minds and from this sort of narrative that we create of I'm alone, nobody understands what I'm going through, and then we panic, right? So I'm thinking about my son right now, my 7-year-old, and some of the major milestones that we've hit in this last year, and teaching him how to swim and having him fall back and float back and, holding his arms and saying, I'm going to let go. And you know what? The water's got you. You will be okay. This, and watching the panic and how he would fight it and then start to sink. There are these metaphors that are so real, it's such a powerful illustration. And then also even watching him learn how to ride a bike, trust that his body could find that balance, to trust that he would be able to within himself find the balance that he needed to do this activity, So, it's right there in my mind, the pictures of it. And so I think, one of the things that I'm taking away from this conversation is that it's an embodied act, this trust, this surrender, this letting go, but that it happens through our will. So we first say, I can do this. I have agency. I believe that there is a greater process taking place. And then to let go of the narrative of panic from that fight or flight mind, and then to relax into what's happening. And to,
exactly.
I don't know, even just to try to have, insofar as it's possible, a playful attitude of what kind of experiment might this become? Like, let's see what life is making here.
Well, there is something like that. I think Teilhard had something of that idea. He thought that nature had this kind of playfulness within it. This what he called the groping or the sensing out. Let's give this a try. This kind of swing it. And so many people are just so afraid to try. To have a new idea or to try something new. And yet that is how life unfolds into something new. Only when we try to ride a bike, right? We try to swim and we might fail. We may fall. We may even feel ourselves going under, but we do get up, we get up again. We trust that we will get up again and we will go on and try it over and over again. Mm-hmm. So willfulness, the will and personal agency are huge, huge factors here, but then also to let go. And allow life, allow life to unfold. If we fall, it doesn't work out. Okay, there's something else going on, though. Hmm. And even just the ability to try allows us to say, well, maybe this direction didn't work out, but I'm willing to at least, try in a new direction, And I think discernment is always important, To just sort of blindly try everything, but really to discern, what is good here? What was this fun or was this really a major catastrophe? Did I enjoy this bike ride even though I failed 3 times on it? And do I want to try this again? So I think we always have to discern, in other words, sift out, right? We have to sift. Am I getting nearer that goal that we talked about before? Or, is it really just muddy waters? And if so, then it's time to just pull back.
Yeah, and to have the courage to try something unexpected and new, because I think we're also so in our ruts of, well, this is what life expects me to do. This is what family structures look like. This is the predictable timeline, and I'm supposed to hit this and this at this, these specific times. And
exactly.
So when we feel that, I don't know, that evolutionary instinct to yearn for something new, different, more. We almost kind of feel like, oh, well, it's okay. I'll just go back to, So I do think it's also that playfulness is also a trust that trust is also a trust in ourselves and in courage of what is becoming or what is wanting to become, to have the imagination to think differently, to stop limiting ourselves so much by what has existed previously as though there were nothing new for us in the future.
Right. I mean, the two things that just come to mind. One, I think most people live on the plains of mediocrity, quite honestly. And I think they get to their old age and they're like, well, it was okay, there's so many things I wanted to do and I should have done or I could have done. And I think, oh, what a shame. You know, we're given one opportunity in life that we know. And I think we just take, you know, we wake up each day and then we trust that this power of God's love is at the heart of our life. And we say, hey, what am I being called to today? What new things are pulling me in a new direction? And I think, truthfully, I mean, a lot of religious life has become, I see this a lot, he says, certainly in religious women, you know, I mean, there's so much talk about doing something new and, you know, trying something new. And, you know, about 10 years ago, I tried something new with a few others. And when it's new, it's really new. You know, you really step out into the unknown. And you really have, and there's no blueprint. I think that's what it's really hard for people to recognize. There is no blueprint. It's never been done before. Like you are really, you know, you are stepping into like onto the moon, you know. And it's really, it's both liberating and it can be exhilarating and it can be deadly frightening because there is no way. There is no, this is how it's supposed to be. You don't even know what you're, you know, moving toward. And yet, I think that is how the future is created. I mean, I think of Steve Jobs' famous speech, you know, at the graduation speech, the future belongs here to the crazy ones, you know, those who think differently, those who think outside the box. And I think at this point, I might put myself at least slightly in the box or outside the box. I feel like Schrodinger's cat, you know. And so that, you know, I think, you know, so that we're not always living like in this world of mental dreams, but that the dreams really begin to take shape in our lives, that we dream the world, you know, literally. We do new things. We do them discern, you know, thinking, yeah, I really feel called in this direction. This is really crazy because, you know, we have no institutional supports. We have really no finances. You know, we have nothing, but we're going to do it, you know, and you do it. And now the thing is, you can't do these things alone, right? You need others with you. You need a community. You need other crazies. You know, you have a community.
Find your crazies.
And that's how, I do think that's how we transcend ourselves. And I think God does empower certain people. I think God gives people enough. The power of craziness and will and dreams and this kind of freedom to do like leaping new things, you know, and they become the growing edges of evolution. I think they become the, and I think someone like Francis of Assisi was sort of like the growing tip of evolution, or an Oscar Romero, or you know, or some of the great desert fathers and mothers, you know, and that's, we're called to do the same thing in our own age. We're called to be growing tips of evolution, not just to be these passive recipients of whatever happens in our world. Like we are to be the personal agents of how evolution, you know, moves up in the future. That is, I think, what I do think that's the Christian call, quite honestly. Mm-hmm. I don't know how we've missed this big time, but we really have.
Yeah.
Like, I think, you know, Jesus says over and over, if you make my word your home, you'll learn the truth. The truth will set you free. I don't find too many people free,
yeah.
You know? We're so, like, stifled, and we're so bound within. Mm-hmm. And he's like, you know, you're not only going to do what I did, you're going to do greater things. You're going to do, like, you know, you're going to do things, like, in this power of the Spirit, this energy of love, this, you know, newness of life. And I'm like, really? It doesn't look that way to me.
Yeah.
And so maybe that's that, you know, maybe that's just what God does to certain people, certain crazies like me. And maybe there's another out there. It could be you.
I'll be your fellow crazy. But it does. I mean, it's a process of. It's almost as if what we're talking about is religion as remembrance. You know, remembering what we're capable of, remembering what evolution has shown us thus far, remembering that we are in a process together, and that we have the capacity to create something new and to think outside the box, as you were saying. You know, so I guess kind of to wrap it up, you know, love in a fractured world, what a theme, right? Because it's you want to say like, love is this element, you know, and then the fractured world is this other thing. And yet, as we're talking, I'm realizing love in a fractured world is a universe in the process of becoming. It is.
There you Sure, great.
You know, it is this element that's binding all of us. It's a net that we can trust. It's yeah. what gives us the capacity to leap forward into the unknown, even mm-hmm. when we're terrified, even when, you know, we feel crazy, and to trust that God, as that net, will be there on the other side to catch us and to draw us into newer connections we couldn't have imagined otherwise.
Yeah, no, I think that's great. I would just say one thing. I don't think God's on the other side. I think God is the crazy love in our midst.
Yeah, there you go. Right. It's the net and the crazy. God is the crazy within. That'll be the Omega theme for, like, you know, January. God is the crazy in your crazy. Well, thank you so much for taking the time to talk, you know, in the midst of your own busy week and to deepen with us all. So thank you, Ilya.
Great. Thanks. All right.
If you want to keep exploring topics like this one, be sure to subscribe at theomegacenter.info. There's bonus content for members only and a question and answer section where you get to ask Ilya anything you want. And whether you're a subscriber or not, be sure to check out the Omega Center blog. We feature a new blog every week, from voices in the fields of theology and science, exploring a new topic every month. I'm Bree Stoner, and on behalf of the Omega Center, thanks for listening.